I found.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us on Three Women, Three Ways. We're the radio show that talks about current events, abuse against women, you name it. We're talking about it, and we talk about it from our three different perspectives. And those, in some ways, are pretty similar, but in other ways, are pretty diverse. So why don't we start out by introducing ourselves? I'm Heather Stark, and I have been interested in the field of domestic violence for about the last 15 years, and I am currently working on a PhD dissertation and hope to use that work to continue my interest in domestic violence and doing things for to try to stem the abuse against women. Deborah is my joining me here is Deborah Ann Pinkley, and Deborah, why don't you give us an introduction?
Oh, I'd be pleased to. Hello, my name is Deborah Adams, and I live in Southwest Washington State. And I have a tagline. It is, I have lived it, I have studied it, and I have worked it. And what I'm talking about is domestic violence. So, survivor of a long-term marriage with four children involved, and at the age of 45, returned to college while I was working for the local community-based anti-domestic violence program. So, I have a three-way perspective on the topic. I'm happy to be here. How about you, Pinkley? Introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Good morning, ladies. Good morning, listeners. This is Pinkley, or Connie Sue. Some just make it simple, and we'll go by Pinkley. How's that? I am a survivor of domestic violence. Have worked in the a local nonprofit domestic violence and sexual assault organization for the last 14 years, went back to school and got my AA degree and my Bachelor of Arts degree, and I'm currently still working in the field and have a great interest, of course, of ending violence in our community and in the world. So let's get started this morning. I'm excited about our topic. I have some very personal ties to this. So, Heather, why don't you get us started on our topic this morning?
Well, I think this morning we're going to talk about domestic violence and religion. And this is, I think, a lot of people don't understand that religious or spiritual abuse is one way that women can be controlled. And I think one of the significant facts about this is that about 85% of the domestic violence people who are experiencing domestic violence are women, and the majority of them turn to their religious community or their spiritual community for some support during this situation. So one of the ways that this can be used against women is by the abuser trying to isolate her from her religious community and her support there. And another way she can be affected by this is when the spiritual community or the religious community doesn't understand what's happening. And when she goes to get assistance there, the assistance and the advice is pretty bad. You ladies have worked in the field. Have you ever seen an example of that in your field?
I definitely have. In my past 20 years of working, it's come up multiple and many times. Most survivors need the support of their faith group, and often they don't receive it, which throws them into another level of chaos. Would you agree with that, Connie Sue?
No, absolutely, 110%, if not more. I think your faith and your spirituality, most of the vows of matrimony or coming together as a union is under the umbrella or the guise of your faith, whatever that might look like. And so today we're not going to just talk about Christianity, but all forms of faith. So I think it's incredibly difficult and extremely isolating if a woman were to go to her faith-based community. Oftentimes the abuser is a pillar of that community. And so where does one turn? So the most critical aspect I would think of today is, for me as a survivor, is to really focus on the faith-based leaders becoming more informed and educated around the complexities of domestic violence.
You know, this is really similar to when we've talked about law enforcement's response to domestic violence and our judicial system response to domestic violence, as well as mental health and community-based responses, because nobody gets training on this specific subject in their, you know, in their on their path to become the minister. And if they do, it's usually very, very minimal. Like in the case of law enforcement officers in Washington State, in their whole law enforcement training, they get 8 hours. And I don't think it is specifically required in for mental health providers to have a specified domestic violence or sexual violence unit in their training. I know it's not for physicians. So this is part of the problem, is people are responding to a very serious concern for their congregation, and they don't have adequate training or feel confident that they know how to respond. How do you feel about that?
Well, I agree. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting here with a study in front of me that shows that, and I won't give the specific numbers, but overwhelmingly women tend to go to their churches or their spiritual leaders for assistance, and yet, excuse me, most of those religious leaders have not received any kind of training in the dynamics of domestic violence or in dealing and assisting domestic violence survivors. So that means that they usually go back and refer to scripture, and depending on what the religion is, and what their feelings about marriage and relationships and women are, women might get help, they might not get help. It's a toss-up for most women. And in fact, sometimes faith is used to justify the abuse.
And absolutely. And the most common response I think survivors of domestic violence get initially from their spiritual leader is, you need to try harder.
Yeah.
You know, are you a godly person? Are you following our holy scripts and our holy texts? And you have to do your best to have the best relationship with your spouse. And that is confusing already to a survivor, because we are already thinking, this person professes to love me, but on the other hand, at the snap of a finger, can turn into someone almost instantaneously, both verbally, emotionally, and physically abusive. So as a survivor, we're already confused, right? Because how can you say you love me and then turn around and hurt me? And then you go to your spiritual leader who says, well, you need to be a better person. So it's kind of like a double bind, would you say?
Absolutely. And I think that what I would like to do right now is to give a shout-out for our listeners and the people who may be chatting with us. There is an absolutely phenomenal organization located in Seattle, Washington. It's called the Faith Trust Institute, and it's faithtrustinstitute.org. And for the sake of really focusing in not just on one religion but all faiths, their guiding principles include, Faith Trust Institute is a national multi-faith, multicultural training and education organization with global reach working to end sexual and domestic violence. And this is a phenomenal resource, and it really talks about the importance of training and education for faith-based leaders. And the director of this organization is
Reverend Marie Fortune.
Yeah. Reverend Dr. Marie M. Fortune, F-O-R-T-U-N-E. And I was reading over this paper that she wrote back in, I think this was 2010, and it talks about a commentary on religion and domestic violence. And she goes on to say exactly just what you were talking about, Deb, the general response about keeping the commandments, everything will be fine, keep praying, get closer, be patient, go to services, and pray harder. Those are some of the most common responses. And people just don't, and it's just not the faith-based, but you've already touched on examples, law enforcement, judicial. Our community is not educated in the dynamics of domestic violence. And this is another institution or another area that people will go to another system for support. And if you're talking about someone's faith, that is so, that's around values and beliefs. So if a response is to pray harder, then that just adds another layer of shame and guilt and isolation.
Well, it also puts the responsibility back on the victim.
Exactly.
You pray harder, you do this, you do that, and that will help with this problem that he's creating.
And it's not holding... it's not holding the person who's doing the harm accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem to me that if a faith group, faith organization, a faith-based community, and we're not talking about the answer is to split this couple up or to get a divorce. Quite the contrary. The response is, you married for better or worse. But what it doesn't do is give the support as a family unit, as holding the abuser accountable, keeping the survivor or the victim safe, and at the same time, if there's children involved, that includes that now you're talking about a family. It's just not the woman who's
right.
enduring these consequences. It's a unit.
Right.
And I would think it's even particularly more challenging when you have an abuser who's part of the congregation as a leader.
Right. And I think because of the non-requirement for training and maybe some even naivete on the spiritual leader's part, they do not recognize domestic violence in their own parishes or groups because this is usually behind closed doors. So most perpetrators of domestic violence will not verbally abuse or physically abuse their spouse in front of a religious leader, right? So that kind of leaves it open for religious leaders to say, well, I don't see it. I don't think it's happening. In fact, when I worked for my past employer, we had a focus on teaching religious leaders. We sent out 300 letters inviting religious leaders to a gathering to have a community talk about domestic violence and religion. And three of the leaders responded, 3 out of 300. And I give credit to those three because they actually attended some of our trainings, and we kept the conversation going a little bit. But even after like 3 or 4 meetings, there was one of the leaders that said, you know, I have a small community. It just doesn't happen in my community. And it was just like, wow. We've just had these conversations. We've just done this sort of, bringing the information to you, and you're still in denial. And that's a really difficult thing to break through.
Right.
Well, especially since women especially African-American women, actually, according to the studies, turn to their religious leaders even before they turn to any other social assistance. So many cases, the religious leader is the first line of defense here.
Yeah. And if someone has a deep-seated faith and feels part of a religious community, that is where they're going to go. So this is a really important connection and a relationship that, you know, we need to be working on to improve the response for anybody within that congregation.
Yeah.
I did a little research, and I was raised Catholic, so of course I'm curious to know what the Catholic Church response is. And I found a document that was created by Catholic bishops' leadership group, and it's dated from 1992. And the very first paragraph says, as pastors of Catholic Church, we state as clearly and strongly as we can, violence against women, inside or outside the home, is never justified. Violence in any form, physical, sexual, psychological, or verbal, is sinful. Often it is a crime. We have called for a moral revolution to replace a culture of violence. So that's pretty strong wording from the Catholic leaders, but this was, I didn't really know about it until I actually started doing the research, right? So I don't think it's a high priority, I guess, for religious leaders. And I have to say that going to church every Sunday the last couple of years again, that I have never once heard a sermon on the topic of domestic violence.
Wow. And yet it is so prevalent. It is so prevalent in our culture.
Well, Catholic churches are usually really large communities. I mean, I think there's probably like 5,000 people in our parish. And for, you know, for that size of a group to be not recognizing it is incredible to me.
Yeah. Wow. And in my research, I discovered that actually the Quakers were very anti-domestic violence. They considered women and men absolutely equal. And if men did something to hurt women and vice versa, they took it very seriously. So, yay on the Quakers. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I have some friends who practice Buddhism, and so I was curious to check them out as well, and I found a really great resource that comes from nursing group within the Canadian Buddhist Culture Center, and here's what they say about domestic violence. It's very, very interesting. That they believe that, where is it? They've got definition. Okay. Buddha's main teaching goal is to provide followers happiness, peace, and salvation. He instructed each family member to live harmoniously together. It's an individual responsibility to refrain from all kinds of violence. And there's five abuses they list: killing, stealing, robbing, raping, telling lies, and consuming drugs and alcohol. They consider that a form of abuse, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And then, so they go into talk about how if you're following your Buddhism, they have five precepts that they need to observe regularly. This is everybody across the board, regardless of gender, identity, or practice or anything. Number one is to refrain from killing, beating, battering, or harming others. You must cultivate compassion and spread it around. Refrain from stealing, robbing, cheating, or corrupting. One must live by a right livelihood. Refrain from committing sexual conduct such as rape and humiliation. One must concentrate on their cravings. Or refrain from telling lies, using harsh words. One must be aware of all speech. And the fifth one, oh my gosh, I just clicked the wrong button. That's not cool.
Where'd it go? So we don't know the fifth one, right?
I'll find it. There it is. Refrain from consuming drugs, addictive things, or drinking alcohol. One must be mindful and conscious. So they're like saying domestic violence fits into this, and we don't actually need a separate and unique response, that if you are a practicing Buddhist, that these are the things you follow and that you will not do that. How's that? What do you think of that? That's how I interpreted that anyway. Maybe you have a different interpretation.
No, I think that's a. I'm actually haven't been exposed to that before. I think it's a very clear and very easy to understand set of premises. So, I think that's a good one.
Yeah.
They come right out and say you don't hurt somebody.
Verbally or mostly, you know, have right language. Don't use words to hurt people. Yeah, I think it's pretty impressive set of principles and practices.
Yeah.
So does Faith Trust Institute have any people that practice Buddhism on their board? Do you know, Pinkley, by looking at their website or looking at their partners?
Yeah, that's the question. I don't know the answer.
I think I know that Reverend Marie Fortune really does want it to be across all religious practices, so I wouldn't be surprised if they did have someone.
I'm looking at the board of directors now. They're from all over the United States, even including Hawaii. But it doesn't say particularly what their faith is. But it's an absolutely astounding website. It's like the principles that you just read off. I mean, isn't in the Christian faith or the Catholic faith, you know, what's like the first Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not kill.
All in the Ten Commandments. Yes.
So it's written, but that doesn't mean that people follow it. And again, you know, highlighting the emphasis that in any faith that it's such a deep-seated value issue and belief. I mean, you pretty much your life is or can be guided by what you believe in, and you marry under this. And to have that destroyed and to not have someone believe you or have the response is just outstandingly frustrating to me. And I can say from my personal experience, that's exactly what I did, and it was awful. It was just simply awful. I went directly to the pastor that married us, and he really had no formal training or any kind of response. And it wasn't until I got a hold of a book, and you've got that book in front of you, Heather, Keeping
yes.
the Faith.
Yes.
That it really, and again, it this book in particular is seated in Christianity, but it can apply to all faith beliefs, and that scriptures are often used in context to hold them against you, but it doesn't give the full scriptures of what the context behind them is, and it's never okay to abuse someone, ever.
Well, and I often hear that scripture of, a woman is to, obey or hie unto her husband, and the husband is the head of the household, implying that whatever he decides to do is just fine. But my understanding is that the complete text of that scripture is that, and the husband is also to obey his wife. Is that correct? I'm not that familiar with scripture, but...
No, it is. I've got it actually in front of me. It says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up to make her holy, cleansing, and so on and so forth. So basically only part of the scripture is being used.
Yeah.
Right, but, you know, that's pretty much a characteristic of abusers, is they're going to find any means and manipulate those means to their partner, to their wife, to their spouse, to gain control over them. So an abuser is not actually, cannot say they're truly a religious person, because they're manipulating their holy text in a way that serves just them and them only, and not their family or their religious community. So I think that's what is hard for religious leaders to recognize, is that the very people who, as you've said, Pinkley, are often pillars of the community, are behind closed doors taking that sacred text and twisting it and manipulating it to have control and domination over their partner. And then using the threat that if you talk about this, you will be the one that will be removed from the community because I am a pillar of this community, right?
Right.
Well, yeah. And that's where the church becomes a barrier to the safety of the female congregants. The church, because you mentioned, Deborah, the minister or the leader do not necessarily see the abuse, they base their assumption on what they do see, and they could be seeing a very pious man who is also a very terrible abuser, but they don't see the abuser part. So the church can become a barrier to women. It's also, some churches are very, very adamant that divorce is never acceptable. Some churches are very adamant that the man is the head of the household, and whatever he does is more or less acceptable, that it's everyone else's role to fall in behind him. So with those tenets, that going to the church leaders and looking for assistance does become a barrier. And as we mentioned before, the instructions are usually go back, try harder, keep the faith, pray harder, and that keeps the woman more isolated.
I found a paragraph in the U.S. Catholic Bishops' report that I was reading from. Here's the paragraph. We emphasize that no person is expected to stay in an abusive marriage. Some abused women believe that church teaching on the permanence of marriage requires them to stay in an abusive marriage. They may hesitate to seek a separation or divorce. They may fear that they cannot remarry. Violence and abuse, not divorce, break up a marriage. We encourage abused persons who have divorced to investigate the possibility of seeking an annulment, which would allow them to remarry in the Catholic Church. But that pretty clearly says that the violence is what breaks up the family and not your actions. But, you know, I was never taught that as a young Catholic girl or as an adult, that, you know, I never heard those words ever spoken in public. So that's the problem here, is we have, in this particular instance, the church leaders are putting together this document, you know, but they're not disseminating that document, and they're not following through to see that this is the information that is passed on to their congregations or their parish.
Well, some churches are a little bit more understanding about divorce in particular. There are a couple of I guess there are like two schools of thought for Lutherans, and one of the schools of thought is a little bit more liberal socially, and they believe that, yes, there is only one true husband that you have as a woman and one true wife, but if the marriage falls apart, if the marriage ends, clearly that one wasn't the right one. That one wasn't the true one. And so, you know, by looking at it that way, it's like, okay, all right, you know, this isn't anything I did. This isn't
I'm not going to be valued or excommunicated from my community because I get a divorce. That's the good thing.
Yes, yes. So I think when we're talking about this issue, I keep going back to the clergy. You know, how much does the clergy really understand about how domestic violence works? And how are they taught or educated about keeping their religious beliefs and also, at the same time, keeping women safe? Is that a discussion in religious training? I don't know.
Well, it's not, you know, I don't know because I've never been to seminary, right? So I can't really speak to that. But it's in this document from the Catholic Church. It says, consider your priests, consider yourself first responders. Your number one priority is safety for victims and children. Number two, accountability for abuser. Three, restoration of relationship if possible, or mourning over the loss of the relationship. So here it is in clear language. If any, priest would care to read the document, It also says, we are encouraged to listen to and believe the victim's story. Help her assess the danger to herself and her children. Refer her to counseling and other specialized services. Ministers should become familiar and follow the reporting requirements of their state. So this is really pretty much right on key. It says couples counseling is not appropriate and can endanger the victim's safety. Now, this is right in line with all the things that I know to be true about domestic violence. How about you, Pinkley?
Well, I concur and agree with all of that. Doesn't mean that they're going to respond to it. Doesn't mean that they're going to read it. It doesn't mean that they're going to practice it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, here's the thing. I always stay true to the belief and thought and hope that a survivor, if we can just get people to listen to their own intuition and to their ideas of knowing that this is not okay, and biblical or spiritual teaching, it's ingrained in us. I mean, I know it was for me as a child, and to go against that thought or that belief is incredibly hard, but yet you expect to go to a faith-based person, a leader, and get the support that you deserve and that you should have. And it saddens me to think that in our society, that's not happening.
Yeah.
And that's why I believe so strongly in this website, this Faith Trust Institute. Not only they do training and consulting on domestic violence, but healthy teen relationships, sexual violence, healthy boundaries for clergy, prevention of sexual abuse by clergy, and child abuse. So it's very encompassing. They've taken this and are providing resources and training in all areas.
Well, I appreciate what you said, Pinkley, about survivors needing to follow their intuition. But I also think that maybe we could encourage survivors, and maybe even specifically women, to use their best critical thinking skills in relationship to their religion. Instead of us just blindly following because this certain individual has been ordained or given a certification or has gone to seminary, does not mean they're the expert on everything, including the religion they're the leader of, right? Everybody has their own personal interpretation of holy texts. And, I mean, it's just so evident to me in looking at my various responses of religious institutes to domestic violence. I did have the opportunity in my liberal arts education to do some religious coursework. And one of the things I found out is, now, this is that all religions, every single one, including Islam, they all teach the same basic tenets or principles or pillars, which is love and compassion and care and, you know, truthfulness. So how all of our religions, you know, even on a macro level, how they fight with each other over I'm the religion, you're not, you know, and all those things affects us too. But I have a Islamic perspective on this DV in front of me, and it says, violence is not acceptable. It's considered a sin, and it is also a crime, and anyone who chooses to be violent will be held responsible and accountable in this life as well as in hereafter. It says men and women are equals. Women enjoy the same status of that of men. In the Quran, it says that you are members one of another. And so women have specific rights. Islam grants women the right to choose their husbands, to seek divorce, to retain their family names, to pursue education, to seek employment, to own property, and to remain in control of their own wealth. So this is coming from the Islam leadership as well. So this was on a website that is the coming out of Canada. It's on the on theirs, and they have a brochure, but this is what this Islamic perspective on domestic violence says. Now, is this something you've ever heard before, Heather?
No, never. As a matter of fact, most of the things I've heard that go on are just the opposite. So where's the disconnect between, you know, the different tenets and different instructions of these faiths?
Yeah,
and
it's actual practice of the faith, right? And the interpretation of those tenets or principles that is getting skewed.
Yeah. Well, I have an actual situation that I wanted to ask you guys about. I have a friend whose husband had been abusive and literally threw her downstairs and then locked her out the front door. She had to go to a neighbor. You know, we know all these things that they can do. She had been very active in her church. After her husband was arrested, he went to the minister of her church and said what had happened, of course, in his version, and that he was very regretful, and that he felt that he should turn to God to help improve this. So the minister actually welcomed him into the church, her church, that she had been to for years. And
he had not been part of it before?
No, no. And when my friend went to services and saw him there, she left because she had a protection order against him. And she then
which is wrong, because it should have been the reverse. He should be leaving, right? We know that.
Yes,
that's the
exactly. But when she then went to her minister and said, this can't be, you know, this cannot be, and he said, but we have an obligation to help a sinner who wants to reform. And so basically the minister said, you know, converting someone new is more important than your safety.
Oh, my.
And I have always been so appalled by that story. She was able to find another church, and she felt, you know, comfortable at the other church and everything. But how could a religious leader do that? I don't understand that.
Well, see, that's his interpretation of his holy text and his priorities. Gosh, I'm dumbfounded by that, and I'm furious, actually, by that response. How about you?
Well, this was several years ago, but nevertheless.
I would say that the abuser did an excellent job at manipulating the situation.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
The abuser got just exactly what he was after, you know, the isolation, presenting himself.
Yeah, he took her very most important support system away from her. How incredibly
wonderfully
sneaky
great
is
abuser.
That?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I would say the guy did a great job at abusing yet another system. And, I mean, the pastor could, the person who responded could have done both, could have held the person accountable and supported that person. And, first of all, the person violated helped to violate the protection order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was
so they need to be educated about that aspect as well. I mean, it's not just about your holy text or scripts. You know, it's you live in our case in the United States, in this community, in this state of Washington, and by being here, you agree to live by the laws of this particular land, right? So you can't take your holy script to overrule all that and say, well, I can have you at church even though we're breaking the law. Yeah, they need to really be informed about that stuff.
Yeah. Well, she told him, you know, that if he was there, she could not come. She would not come because of the protection order, and the minister made his choice.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, unfortunately, I've heard many stories like this, and every time I get really agitated about it, because this is such an inappropriate response, just on a human basis, whether you're a spiritual leader or not.
Illegal.
This
it's
is
illegal.
An
you're not,
inappropriate
you're not,
response
yeah.
to someone coming to you for help that you would say, well, this person has higher priority over you. I mean, yeah, like Pinkley said, they maybe could have worked it out. In fact, you know, there are ways to do that. But, you know, like you can't come to these events because she's going to be there, but you can come to these events or whatever.
Or you come to a different service, and if that service, you know, if there's only one service.
Or you come as an individual, not at the communion times, you know, whatever.
Right. Or I make a referral to another church that is of equal level of spiritual awakening that you profess that you're sorry about.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that. So I think the abuser did, you know, the abuser gets an A+.
Yeah.
As they often do.
Yeah.
On manipulation for the best of
them. An A+ on manipulation, isolation, taking control of the situation.
Oh, yeah.
While at the same time professing that he was so sorry. Mm-hmm. And really,
and if he truly was sorry, why would he want to remove that community and that support from him?
Exactly, exactly.
No, he's not truly sorry. If this is the only religion he can now join all of a sudden.
Now, if he truly was, let's take the optimistic highway.
Only Pinkley would take the optimistic eye.
Oh my gosh.
If in fact that person really had some sincere hope inside of change, the pastor, that person failed that particular individual. He did not do his job.
Yeah.
No.
He did not. He should have done other means of intervention as opposed to saying, I mean, hell, we're all sinners. If you want to look at it from a faith perspective, but what did not happen is holding that person accountable.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I used to do pre-sentence reports for one of the counties here, and we had child abusers that we would have to interview. And one of the people I worked with said, if you're a child abuser and you're looking for victims, the best thing to do is go to church, stand up before the congregation, and say, I was a child abuser. I have now, I regret it. I feel horrible. Now I'm turning to religion to take care of, you know, this problem. And he said that you would have people in the congregation rushing forward to leave you with their children.
You know, I have another friend. Her name is Savina, and she has her own company called Silent Spirits. And this is exactly what she's talking about, is she says that abusers, predators, pedophiles are grooming everybody in the world to be open arms and accepting of them and allowing them into places where they can commit their crime easier.
Yeah.
And that is one of her main points, is that, you know, we have to play the game smarter than these criminals, right? Because if that's what you're doing, if you are purposely going to a community and using them in that bold way, that is truly should be the crime right there.
Yes, exactly. But
yeah,
I think that
they really tend to look for single mothers in particular.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I really think that now that she and I have been having these conversations, I'm really leaning towards agreement on that, because how many times have we heard this as an advocate, Pinkley, that, oh, yeah, I'm with someone and we're married now and it was after the abuse of the other, and, oh, I just found out he's a sex offender.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? You just found out wasn't something he you know, told you on his introduction?
Oh, yeah.
No, it's not going to be. So here again, not only about following your own tuition, people, but be critical thinkers. Do not just blindly accept what someone says to you. We cannot afford that luxury of being so naive anymore, because, as Connie said too, we're all sinners, right? We all have a past. We all carry baggage. You should know what your people's baggage is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and in fact, in my community, there's a very large, one of those mega churches, and they open their arms. They particularly seek out domestic violence survivors as to have as members of their congregation, because they want to offer assistance and a special helping hand to domestic violence survivors. And what happened is that they started getting all sorts of men coming to this congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that many of those men have a history of domestic violence.
Yep.
So
yep.
Basically what
a
you've
big
done...
big community for them to, you know, seek out future victims.
Yep.
It's
you
given me
this. Basically opened a shopping center for abusers.
So I want to give kudos to that church or that faith-based community for wanting to support survivors. A great big shout out. But if you're gonna do this work, you gotta know the issue. You gotta know the complexities of it. You can't just say, "Oh, come to my house and I'll keep you safe." That is not how it works. That was as you were starting to tell that story, I just imagined this brand new point of entry for abusers to come to. I mean, they go to places where they can prey on people who've had trauma in their lives, because they're going to rescue them, right?
People who are vulnerable,
it was just like, wow. And, you know, I think that here's the thing. I mean, if people present as being a faith-based person, you always think of the good in that person. And you want to believe that person, especially if they turn around and say, "I'm in love with you," or "I care about you," or "I want to be married to you." I mean, nobody's perfect. We all have our stuff.
I'm thinking, too, that maybe this even plays into the whole blame the victim thing, because many survivors have said, you know, I can't, every person I'm involved with is abusive to me. And so I'm wrong for picking abusive people. And I always would say to them, I think it might be more the opposite, that abusive people are looking for your vulnerabilities.
Exactly.
And this story just so illustrates that so perfectly, Heather, is that you don't go out there and say, "I'm going to pick the most abusive person out there to be with." You go out there looking for someone, and you want to use your care and your compassion and follow your religious or whatever your ethics are. You know, you're, as you say, looking for the good in people. But abusers don't care about any of that. They're looking for an angle, for a way to find the most vulnerable people so they can get their needs met as quickly as possible. And that's another thing. That's one reason why I always say quick involvement is a total red flag for me. "Hi, my name is Deborah. I love you. Let's get married." That scares me. You know? I don't think quick involvement was one of the flags that I totally did not recognize. But on hindsight, I think I just want that message to be out there, that there's no rush to get married. Take your time. You know this person and know what their baggage is. Know how true they are to their professed beliefs and standards, and find out for sure. You know, use your critical thinking. Don't just be naive and blindly go forth.
Well, and there's a lot of assumption if you meet someone that you have this common bond of, let's say, this common thread or this common belief or faith. Whatever that might look like, you know, whether you're, you know, whatever. So you're operating from that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're operating from an assumption that you have the same beliefs, the same values, the same spiritual connection. So you would not take any presumption or idea that this person would be abusive.
Well, you almost look at it as a safety net, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Like, we're in a little bubble here. We're in our own little utopia because we're both following the same religion and we still have these same beliefs. And we've both had checkered pasts or whatever, however you want to, you know, term it. But so you think that's actually a safety net, and
exactly.
It just makes you more vulnerable, in
and
my opinion.
And you know what? It should be, but it isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't always that way.
Well,
no.
Ladies, this conversation makes me think, okay, if I'm a member of a religious community and I really want to practice my faith, do I have an obligation to bring this message to the clergy? Do I have an obligation to go to my clergy person and say, you know, we're not doing anything about this, this issue of domestic violence, and we should be. We should be doing that. We should be exploring how our religion views women and views abuse. And we should be making that information open information for everybody in the congregation.
I absolutely think that that is a utopic idea, but it doesn't mean that it can't happen. The first thing I would want to do is I was brought up being Methodist. So I'm going to just use that as an example. Just because Methodist pastor so-and-so or whatever is practicing that faith doesn't mean that that response is going to be unified from one church to the next. And
no, it doesn't. But I personally, I'm feeling that way about my Catholic religion and the parish that I attend, because I go to church with my mom on Sundays, and I'm really starting to feel a pressure to bring this up with our head, our lead priest,
yes.
Because, like I said, I've never heard any of this, anything from the 1992 Catholic Bishops report. I've never seen anything, they just never bring up domestic violence or sexual assault in any way, shape, or form.
I think
so. I personally am feeling some obligation, pressure building up in me to go do that. But, you know, you can't, it's not your job. It's not like you have to do it. It's a personal conviction, right? Heather, you know.
I think that the best way to approach it would be to ask, what is our church's practice or model in addressing domestic violence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would you do if someone came and presented to you, hypothetically, I'm in this particular situation? I think just getting the conversation started, I think it's a really difficult conversation, because you want to come to this faith-based community and feel safe, but if you're bringing forth an issue that's not, it's heartbreaking. I mean, it's like a conflict, an internal conflict. But how many times have we heard, you know, clergy and priests abusing children? And so I think that the idea or the assumption or the myth that that's all a safe place, like you were saying, Deb, our naivety is... Bring it forward and say, what is our church, is this church right now, or this congregation, or this place of worship, what is the practice of addressing, or the model of addressing domestic violence and sexual assault, sexual abuse, and children coming forward and disclosing? It's just not how we deal with the adults, but it's also about how do we deal with children. And everybody would agree, for the most part, that yes, it's our job to protect children. So we may even start with that. Like, what is our policy?
And a lot of religions do have their own schools these days.
Which is no guarantee that they won't hire an inappropriate person. But I think that... it seems to me that it needs to be more in the open. It needs to be talked about. It needs to be more in the open, because the more you don't talk about it, the less a person in that congregation would feel like they can come to the church for support. And if there's a conversation going on about it, routine conversation. I was recently, and I wish I could remember the name of it, I recently saw a video of an older minister. I don't remember his particular faith. It was a Christian faith. And he has made it a practice over the last few years to visit churches and talk about domestic violence, just domestic violence, and try and educate the congregations about what this is and, you know, what you can do and how you recognize it. And I think it's probably because of his age. He's very non-threatening. I mean, people seem to come in large numbers to see him and hear what he has to say. But I was privileged enough to see one of his videos, and gosh, he does a good job. He just does a good job. And in the interview, he said that it came to his attention that this is what's going on, and this is what his churches need to address, and they're not doing it. And so he has made that his personal mission to bring that out in the open and to be a visiting pastor to other churches to talk about that issue.
That's amazing.
You know, I did my research, and I told you that it was 1992 and the Catholic Church wrote that. Well, last year, a group of Catholic women got together to try to create a national network against domestic violence, and they actually have a Facebook page. So
oh, wow.
I am going to put that information on our Three Divas Facebook, so that if you would like to go and check out that article that that talks about their plan for the national, then you'll have that available. Because I think it's interesting that, you know, Catholic women are not allowed to be priests, but yet it's Catholic women who are striving the most to bring this forward as an issue. And so I just think that, you know, that says a lot about the strength of women, that even though we are survivors and we do need a religious faith or a community, that we still feel the need to, as you said, Heather, bring it out, talk about it, and make it well known and have an adequate and appropriate response on all levels. I think that's so important.
Yeah. Make it part of the conversation. Make it out there so that people don't feel ashamed. The more we have things out in the open, the less shame there is involved. And so that people can learn more about their particular religion and what they believe, and so that they can work for change if that's required. I just think that, of course, you know, I mean, you know me, I'd probably be a loudmouth and I'd be kicked out next week, but...
Well, I also found a website, and I'm sure they have a Facebook page as well, for a Muslim organization working against domestic violence. And the name of their website is Peaceful Families Project, and it's a national organization. And that's where I actually got the information about their take on violence against women. I also found another one. It's called Project Sakina, S-A-K-I-N-H, Stop Family Violence Now. And they have a page that says Take Action Now. It says Wake Up, Speak Up, Team Up, Stop Family Violence Now. And the Blessed Prophet Muhammad is reported to have said, if one of you sees something wrong, let him change it with his hand. If he cannot, then with his tongue. If he cannot, then with his heart. This is the weakest faith, if you wait till you do it from the heart. But to physically do something and to use your voice, I thought that was kind of important to just kind of validate what we're saying here, too, that there must be some action.
Absolutely.
And
I
just want to do a really quick shout out. Since I've been doing this work, I just can't say enough times, it's going to take a community. It takes a community to end violence. And that means that includes the faith-based community.
That's a great summary, huh, Heather?
It is. We've had, I think this has just been a really, really interesting conversation, and I have to tell you that I'm not a particularly religious person, and yet I have enjoyed this discussion tremendously. So I would, you know, if you've been listening and you also got a lot out of this conversation, refer your friends to our archive page. They can go. You can go to our webpage and get a link so that you can hear our program at a later date. And if you would like to pass this on to somebody that you think could benefit from it, please feel free to do that. Meanwhile, bye-bye. We're going to be back next week, same time, because we are...
Three women.
Three ways.
Three divas.
Yeah. Have a great week, everybody.